I would start with the disclaimer of, like, thank you for inviting me to talk about things that I don't know much about, but none of you invited me. Actually, Richard insisted that this is an IP conference, that someone like myself participate, maybe because surely because of the contractual angle, we're talking about licensing. And so I tried to bring to the fore some issues that have to do with contracting, private law, and remedies that are implicated in IP adjudication and licensing breach and infringement issues. So hopefully I will not get, when I characterize things that go on in the world of IP licensing, I will not do it, will not get things wrong. In any event, I think that there are some elements that come from the perspective of remedies that ought to be highlighted and that could be useful for people thinking about IP. Okay, so the basic question is the following. A licensee, someone has a license to commit, say, to engage in some legal uses, commits unauthorized, unlicensed use. Thank you. What is the damage measure? And I'll give an example, and then I'll show what the choice is in the law. But the example is, suppose that the it comes from, so just press, yeah. So it comes from famous cases. The licensee has the purchased the right, or is has the right to distribute the paperback edition of a copyrighted work, and it can commit several types of violations. And I'll use the word violation for a generic wrong. We don't know yet whether it's breach and infringement are the technical words that we want to distinguish. So one violation is premature distribution. Is this breach or is it an infringement of the copyright? Another violation is a distribution in media not licensed, so e-book. Another violation could be maybe, you know, an egregious violation, changing the content, playing around, changing the ending so it'll sell better. Is this a breach of contract or is it infringement? Now, damages might differ here. You see, there's different egregiousness, gravity to the violation, but they differ not because of the gravity, and this is the key legal issue here. They differ because there are different ways to measure them, different methodologies. If we characterize it as breach, it comes from contract law. If we characterize it as infringement, it comes from property or IP law. So I try to highlight two problems, methodological problems, that are in search of a solution. I don't think I have necessarily a very good solution for them. I think maybe the more interesting part of my talk is identifying the problems, the puzzles. The first one, is it a breach of license or infringement of IP? So let me first just quickly chart the plan of the paper and the talk, and then I'll get a little bit more detail. If it's breach, contract damages, contract remedies, and we're talking here just about how to measure damages, not about other remedies, equitable remedies and the like. Contract remedies are the foreseeable lost profit. But you can prove, couldn't be mitigated and so on. Infringement remedies, damages are different. Sometimes you get disgorgement. Sometimes you get, you know, there are statutory remedies, more likely to get attorney fees. They, in a large subset of cases, they are higher than the contract damages. In another, they are lower. So it is important to distinguish the measure. Again, premature to take from the case, U.S. Naval Institute, a Second Circuit case from early 90s, of the distribution of the book, The Hunt for Red October. The paperback distributor breached or violated the license by distributing the book prematurely. The loss, it caused some loss of sales, lost profit to the right holder, to the owner, in terms of sales of hardcover. That, I think, in the case, what was claimed in that measure amounted to $35,000. Infringement remedy, the profit from extra sales of the paperback were alleged to be $700,000. Now, I think that were way overstated, not the right way to measure what were the extra sales, but they were substantially higher than the lost profit. Which measure should we use? Disgorgement versus expectation damages. In other cases, and there are interesting examples in which the plaintiff wants contract damages, not infringement damages, for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes when you the infringement suit brings to opens up issues of the patent invalidation of a patent, you know, the owner doesn't want to get into that. They want contract damages. And the defendant would say, no, no, you can only get IP damages and wants to. So we'll see there are also procedural issues. But that is the basic problem of breach versus infringement. The second problem has to do with, suppose it is infringement. How do we measure damages for infringement? Now, there are people in this room that have thought a lot and know a lot and thought much more interesting thoughts than I have on this issue. But I think that there is an angle that was not highlighted so far, and it could be quite substantial sometimes. There are two basic ways in the law to measure infringement damages, which I call the ex post damages and ex ante damages. Ex post damages are the actual proven lost profit to the right holder, say in a patent case, or the actual profit to the infringer in a disgorgement remedy case in copyright. These are damages that are calculated based on post infringement time of adjudication information. What actually happened? They are consistent, we'll talk about it in a minute, with the idea of getting things accurate in terms of compensation, the indemnity principles, loosely speaking. Ex ante damages are damages that are not based on that ex post available information. There are things like the hypothetical royalties that would have been charged in the negotiation between the parties, expected profit, and the calculation is based on pre-infringement information. Even though it's done ex post, we ignore what we know about these parties. It's just like workers' comp. You know, use some kind of averages. So, I will say that there are these two measures. Which one is the right one that applies? What we'll identify when we get to talk about it a little bit more detail in a minute is that there is the way the law applies them. You know, each one is sensible, but the way they're applied in practice and the combination of the two creates a kind of a surprising, I think, anomaly and distortion. So first, let's go back to the breach versus infringement. The problem is that the distinction between what is breach and what is infringement is done, I think, using methodology that is incorrect. We're trying to figure out whether there's something about the nature of the violation that is more like copyright or IP or more like contract, rather than think about the functionally, what is the measure of damages that will get incentives right? And once we know if we want higher damages or lower damages, just affix a label to it, infringement or breach. Breach and infringement, I will argue, ought to be the conclusion, not the building block of the analysis. But how does the law do it? It does it as in the following way, use all sorts of, I think, are superfluous distinctions. So, for example, whether the license that was breached, that was violated, was exclusive or non-exclusive. So the logic is, here's from that same Hunt for Red October case, an exclusive licensee gets, the exclusive license is a transfer of ownership of copyright rights. The new owner of these rights, the licensee, is incapable of infringing a copyright interest that is now owned by him, so he cannot be an infringer by definition, by the nature of the transaction. He's only capable of breaching the license obligation. That doesn't apply to a non-exclusive licensee. So that's one example, that one distinction that is drawn. Another distinction is whether the license was created, the violation was of a promise by the licensee or of a condition precedent. If the licensee violated a promise, that's a breach. If the licensee instead violated a condition, then the license never really was perfected.
You can't use the word violated.
It did not perform. Okay. In all of these situations, it is an action by the licensee. So I'm using the word violation, and as I said in advance, in a loose, generic way. Not attaching to it any legal consequences. Breach and infringement are the technical terms, but if it is a condition that was violated, that was not performed, it is an infringement. Now, it is notoriously known for all contracts, you know, people and other, you know, everybody, that the distinction between promise and condition is artificial, is mechanical, is functional. There's no, many things look like both. Insurance contracts, insurance policies are full of quote-unquote conditions that courts oftentimes call them promises, not conditions, because they want to not let the parties have this easy, mechanical way to change the consequences just by changing the crust that they put over some particular content of the transaction. Another distinction that is drawn is between limitation on the scope of license versus a negative promise. If it is, you violated a limitation, so here's an example. The license, let's say the contract, the license says the licensee agrees to engage only in specific use X. What happens if the licensee engages in use Y? Did they commit a breach of this promise or an infringement? If it is a limitation on the scope, if it is characterized as a limitation on the scope of the license, anything else is beyond the license, is not in the license, it's an infringement and opens the door for infringement damages. If it is understood as a negative promise, a promise, not, I promise not to do anything other than X, then if I do Y, I breach the promise, I breach the contract, and you just get expectation damages.
I'm sorry, just a quick question.
Let me just run by, just clarifying?
Yes.
Okay.
Are you ruling out the possibility of both?
No. I'll talk about, we'll see also that both also can sometimes kick in, which create, you know, a second layer of problems. But we have a problem of knowing which is which. And that's what I'm trying to show now. Additional rules come from jurisdiction. It's very important to know which is which because infringement cases go to federal courts, breach cases go to state contract law courts. Does it arise under copyright or is, so that there are the tests here? It's for, maybe I'm not too familiar. I concede that I don't know all that well the body of law that governs this. You know, Nimmer says that this is one of the naughtiest issues in his language in all of copyright jurisprudence. So who am I to say that I know what's going on? But there are things like court said, is there something here more than just an aroma of copyright? When you hear terms like this, you know that there is really no underlying methodology. Is it part of the subject matter of copyright? One of the rules that is used here, which is an easy, simple, bright line rule, is the well-pleaded complaint rule, used in many other areas of the law as well. If the complaint alleges something that is copyright, then it goes to federal court. If it's we need to understand what is it that it alleges. Another distinction between breach and infringement is with regard to the cancellation rights. If the violation gives rise to rescission, cancellation of the contract, and if cancellation occurred, sometimes there is an automatic reversion clause or automatic cancellation, so or other times there is the right to cancel. But if cancellation occurs, then there is no license. If there's no license, anything that the defendant did is infringement. On the other hand, if it cannot be canceled, then it could be breach. So the cancellation can affect the outcome. To Scott's point, can the owner join the complaint for both and see, you know, whatever gets, so this is the crucial question. I think procedurally the answer is yes. You can join the complaint for both. Can you recover both? Well, no. Generally, you cannot recover both. It depends what is the how it is characterized in the end. And as we saw, it depends on fairly arbitrary and small differences in the facts can lead to large discrete differences in the recovery. That's the problem that we see, this discontinuity, the fact that you can have large pile of damages, a small pile of damages, which one are you entitled to? It's not, does not depend on some measures of the gravity of the wrongful act, but on all of these characteristic that we just, but it's Cardozo, here's an old rule. I think it doesn't truly characterize my understanding of present law. The author who suffers infringement of his copyright at the hands of licensee may seek redress under IP law in federal courts, but that is not in all circumstances the only remedy available. In the same act is not merely an invasion of statutory right of property, but also the breach of a contract, and you can get contract damages. So basically he says, choose. But the choice is not, okay, and the choice is not completely free. So that is one puzzle. Why, what's going on? How do we straighten up? How can we draw a better line? The second puzzle is the following, between ex post and ex ante damages. So the ex post measure, we said it is in patent law, it's the actual lost profit, let's say in copyright, and I'm oversimplifying things just to try to give you the full geometric picture of what's going on. In copyright law, it's the disgorgement of the infringer's profit. So this is a common remedial technique we see everywhere, tort law. You know, you actually want to figure out what the loss was, given on all evidence that we can collect now post-violation. The ex ante measure in patent law, it's the hypothetical royalty. In copyright law, maybe it's the statutory damages. It is independent of the actual magnitude of harm or of some actual realization of some parameter, but it's based more on averages. It is also a common remedial technique, I said, based on averages, schedules, less information, the workers' comp model. Okay. The problem is that the plaintiff, again, can choose, in effect, the greater of the two. So you say, okay, well, it's no big deal. But as I want to show you is that it creates maybe not subtle, maybe all, when you see it not so subtle, a distortion and a substantial one. It leads to excessive compensation, and the excess is due to irrelevant factors. It gets compensation wrong. No theory that can explain it. So let me give you an example. Compare three patents. They are identical in their expected value. The expected value is $1,000. Patent A is a sure success of $1,000. I'm oversimplifying. I don't know. You can never know about things. But just to get the essence of what's going on. Patent B is a toss-up. There's a 50% chance that it'll be double as valuable, $2,000. And patent C is a long shot, you know, kind of, how do you call it in the field? The money ball or something? Yes. Something like that.
Yeah.
A small chance, but of a big, big, you know, gain. $100,000. They're all in expected value $1,000. What are the damages for each one of them is infringed? Should they be liable for a different expected damages? Should the infringer say, I need to know which one I'm infringing in the front, because I might be liable in terms of the insurance policy that I might want, or that my self-insurance cost is going to be different for each one. Say, no, they shouldn't be different. It's the same cost you are, expected cost. There should be the same expected value of damages, at least ex ante. Well, let's see. Patent A, the ex post measure is, you know, after you infringe, there will be suit. If we apply the lost profit measure, it's going to be $1,000. If we apply the ex ante measure, the royalty fee, it's going to be $1,000. That's what the owners would have asked for it. $1,000 was the value of the patent. So either or, it doesn't matter. The expected recovery is, you can choose whichever one, but they give you the same amount. Patent B, that's not the case. The ex post measure is either $2,000 if the patent ends up to be a winner and the infringer enjoyed a $2,000 value, or zero if it ended up being a lose, no value. The ex ante measure, hypothetical royalty, is still the same, $1,000. But now the expected recovery is higher because when the ex post measure is high, that's what the plaintiff will ask. And when the ex post measure is zero, then he'll ask for the ex ante measure, the hypothetical royalty. And to the extent that we say, yes, you can have hypothetical royalty because that's what, at the time, you parties would have negotiated before you knew how it would realize, then the value is $1,500. The situation is worse for patent C. Here, the ex post measure is either $100,000 or zero, and the ex ante measure is still $1,000. So the expected recovery, there's 1% chance that you'll go for, that it was, you know, the ex post measure will be used for $100,000, 99% chance that the ex ante measure will be used, and you get an expected recovery of almost $2,000. It is equivalent to the, it is as much, this way of doing remedies is like, in a different paper that I wrote on a similar problem, I analogized it to a lottery ticket. Imagine that you lose, that I lose a lottery ticket, and you find it. How much, what is, and suppose that the only way to recover is to get damages from you. How much should I recover? Well, you can say the value of the ticket when it was found, $10. Or you can say the value of the ticket is realized after the lottery. If it won $1,000, you get $1,000. If it didn't, you get zero. But what the law does is say, if the lottery ticket ended up, this law, what it does is saying, if the lottery ticket ended up being a winner, you can collect the actual winning from the finding party. If it ended up being a loser, oh, then you get your $10 back. And so it means that the lottery ticket is more valuable when lost. The patent here is more valuable when infringed, when the patentee has the right to choose which one of the two. So this is the kind of sterile structure that I superimpose on what I argue to be a law that allows the patentee to choose between the two measures. And now we can debate, do they really know, get the right to choose? You know, from reading Mark Lemley's writings, I'm kind of persuaded that to some extent, yes, from reading the case law, I have examples in which this is the case, but maybe I'm exaggerating the problem. It is this that we want to stay away from. Yes?
Yeah, this is basically a problem, not distinct as intellectual property, it's right. A problem of election of remedy.
That's right.
And so you have in the encroachment cases the choice of either taking the trivial amount of the infringement or forcing to pull down the building.
Exactly.
And in many trespass cases, you get the option between trespass and restitution.
Which exactly.
Are different numbers. The justification that's been given for those things is not that we like the ex post gaming, but we like the ex ante effect, because if we essentially overload the remedy side, what we do is we reduce substantially the probability of either breach or infringement.
That's
so
right.
I'm just curious as to whether or not that figures into your overall analysis. I mean, because this
absolutely.
Is...
Absolutely. And I think that it's... I think in other areas where the law does... Sometimes this kind of structure, allowing the aggrieved party to choose the greater of the two damages, is done consciously. And the rationale is kind of deterrence. So I think the best example is for the fiduciary who steals the money. You know, if the money and uses them for... takes him to Las Vegas and gambles, if he wins, disgorgement of everything. If he loses, then you have to give back the money. And the idea is we want to deter this kind of behavior. The problem with this explanation is that deterrence is based on factors that are irrelevant. Let me just show it here in the next slide. Not only we get more compensation than the actual value taken, but the excess compensation depends on the following factor. How volatile is the distribution of gains? That should be an irrelevant factor. That is not, it's like giving the party the right to get back the value plus a put option, which depends on the variance of the distribution. That does not seem the right way to get deterrence. You want to get more deterrence, you should factor it, base it on the probability of detection, on other things, but not on the value of a put option. That seems to be wholly irrelevant.
There's a more fundamental problem, right, which is in patent law, and this may distinguish your treatment of patent and copyright. We don't want deterrence most of the time, right? Because the overwhelming number of patent infringement cases are inadvertent infringement. They're not deliberate copying. And we have a separate mechanism for enhancing damages for willful infringement when we do find that there is copying.
Right.
So you'd be overcompensating systematically to the extent you tried to deter at all.
Exactly. I totally agree with that. I think that this is not a breach of fiduciary relationship. And even to the extent that it was, this was kind of an egregious, willful, plunder of patents. It's not clear that this is the right way to get extra deterrence. Yes?
So, Omri, I'm wondering if the difference between the ex post and the ex post measure is often, as you describe it, as you have posited here, a difference in the variability of possible outcomes and the degree of risk associated with the future profits, or if it's a difference in just idiosyncratic stuff that you know that is different for each patent, but that might be known to licensor and licensee in a way that they aren't to strangers. I'm sort of cutting to the chase here and consolidating the two pieces.
Say a little bit more about it.
It might be, I mean, one of the things that you said later in criticizing this analysis, the normative bite of this, is that it leads to, paradoxically to letting off the hook the licensee infringer more likely than mm-hmm. the, and I can't remember quite how you got there,
yeah.
But you said something along those lines. And I'm thinking here, it might be that the licensee is peculiarly able to anticipate the actual lost profits in a way that a stranger infringer wouldn't be. And that what we really want, that's the real measure of damages, is how much is the actual harm that's been suffered. And this ex ante substitute may be something that is useful because it's really hard to observe that. But in the licensing context, you have you have the parties better able to know that. So I'm wondering if the way you've sketched out these three examples is really the way it works or not. You've made it look more like buying a lottery ticket, and I wonder if that's really what's going on. You know, given that patent, at least I don't know about the copyright side, but patent damages are measured as of the time of infringement, not as of some earlier ex ante moment of entering into a license agreement, right? So it may be that often, by the time of the infringement, you have better information, at least those parties have better information, I don't know. I don't know that there's such a difference between the ex ante and the ex post, I guess. I don't know.
Okay, I think there are two different things here. Whether there could be that the ex ante measure, and I think one of Marx's papers shows this very nicely, that sometimes the ex ante measure is not really ex ante. We try to figure out what it would have been the hypothetical royalty, but we don't really know how to pretend that we don't know anything about what actually real lies and how good the patent is. Can't really put ourselves in the original situation that the parties in a hypothetical negotiation would have been. And I think some more savvy courts have recognized that this is what's going on and have kind of been a little bit more self-critical. But it is, it still operates to increase damages to a super compensatory level because when the patent, it is often that if the patent turns out to be really valuable, we'd say, okay, the hypothetical license would have been higher. It is hardly, I haven't seen many cases in which the patent is not valuable and the court says, well, that means that you wouldn't have paid any royalty for it at the original negotiation. So I think largely we have, the fact that the ex ante measure is not a pure ex ante measure is only, does not disrupt the main finding that we have excess compensation. What I want to do is to try to figure out why we have, is there good justification for excess compensation, but let's.
So I'm just looking at 35 U.S.C. 284, and just to try to bring it back to the statute, it just says, upon finding for the claimant, the court shall award the claimant damages adequate to compensate for the infringement, but in no event less than a reasonable royalty for the use made of the invention by the infringer, together with interest and costs as fixed by the court. Okay, so this, you can read this to have nothing to do with ex ante or ex post at all, right? The question is, what's the value of a reasonable royalty, right? And what's compensation? So thinking about your model, I think would tend to agree with Rebecca that the difference between ex ante and ex post kind of collapses, right? It's not that the royalty is necessarily calculated one or the other. It's kind of unpredictable ex ante to the potential patent owner which the court is going to do. Because what your model does is it imposes a bit more coherence on what courts actually do than what courts actually do. Right? So I think I would be tempted to argue if I were a plaintiff for a construction of what the reasonable royalty is that looks more ex post-ish, if ex post it turns out that there's more information that suggests it's more valuable. That I would be tempted to argue for a calculation of the reasonable royalty that's more ex ante-ish if, for example, my ex ante calculation was it's immensely valuable, and it turns out ex post that it's somewhat less valuable, but still quite valuable, so I'm in court, right? And that would tend to put me in a position, you know, of trying to take advantage of what information I have. And the defendant tries to argue the other way, right? But who's going to win? Is it systematic that one argument's going to be more persuasive than the other?
So, Chris, I think the answer is yes, it is systematically different because of the lost profits reasonable royalty structure, right? So I'm entering the market, and I don't know if I'm going to succeed or flame out. Right? I enter a market and succeed, I'm in the market, and I sue my infringer, I get lost profits, right? Which is the ex post measure. Mm-hmm. In the very circumstance in which it's successful, that is, it's high. I enter the market and I fail, I die, I'm no longer a market participant, I don't have any lost profits, I go to the reasonable royalty floor, which the statute gives, that's the ex-ante measure, in the very set of circumstances in which ex post is low.
Is reasonable royalty the measure even after you know the product has gone fist? Why isn't the royalty the amount that you got in the market, which was zero?
So, Richard, is an excellent question. I think actually the royalty ought to be zero in many cases, but no court has ever found a reasonable royalty to be zero, and the Federal Circuit wouldn't do it, precisely because I think they use this ex-ante measure.
Could I ask one other question about
this? Just want to say one thing about the question. I think that, you know, Richard immediately noticed that this is a general problem. I have a paper from a few years ago in which I survey a whole host of areas in private law where this is going on, and bring a little bit more evidence than just the language of the statute, actually how courts do that and try to figure out, and many times inadvertently not noticing that that's what's going on. You rarely see language that's so clear as here, that when you can get this, and in any event, no less than that. This is kind of, it epitomizes the structure of the choosing the greater of ex post ex ante.
I'm not
an expert on how exactly these things are calculated in patent licensing cases. I mean, I'm far from being, you know, even a kind of a novice in this particular area. So I'm suggesting that this is something that, you know, if what you want to take from this is caution not to do this in the wrong way. Maybe you say courts are generally get it right, they're smart, they, you know, and so they don't do that. This, my impression is that it's not as clean an area,
The question that you get about, this stuff is exactly when you trigger these kinds of situations and when you don't. And it's just not at all clear to me that the problem is going to be extremely large because of context. And let me give you the point here, is that if you have a license, you've already got information. This is an ongoing thing. You're not in the zero frame of the world. And the likelihood of an inadvertent breach, if you have a contract and so forth, seems to me to be much lower than it is going to be if it's a kind of a stranger case. And so if you have all of that kind of context around there, the variance strikes me as being much lower than it would have otherwise have been. So the problem seems to be much smaller. So I think this is a real problem with respect to stranger cases. But I'm not so sure it's a real problem with respect to the licensee cases. And a lot of it's going to depend upon the question, which you've yet to get to and you've got 5 minutes to address, which is you gave those two examples. And my view is if you basically get a license agreement and you put it in 10-point type instead of 12-point type, that's a breach of contract. It's only when you put out the hardback edition, which you don't have the license, where it's got to be a deliberate breach. So to me, after you add all the context, then I think that the problem shrinks rather than gets larger. And it's in the stranger cases where it actually makes more difference.
Well, so I hope to get to that. I agree with you, but we think about the last comment, you know, the font versus the. Yeah. But I think we need a foundation for that. I think it's just saying we know it when we see it doesn't work for court. I just saw, you know, they use a variety of clumsy mechanisms. You know, the type of license, is it a condition or a covenant? I think
You actually have to go through the examples rather than the terminology to see whether the sorting is as coherent as the language.
I agree to that, yeah. Go ahead.
I guess it's sort of on this point. This is touching things that you and the others have said already. You know, your answer here might be very different for patents and for copyrights, right? So copyrights, you don't have this sort of accidental copying, and so you may want to treat the person, the stranger, more harshly, because why didn't they go and take the license? Whereas patents, you can have all sorts of accidental infringements out in the field, and so the person who already has the license knows of the patent and should be taking more action. That might be the person who wants to treat more harshly.
I thought we were talking about software licensing, and isn't software subject to copyright? So, my view here, you know, is really kind of zoom out, and I don't really know that. I never taught patents or copyright, but taught contracts and remedies, and so grant me that a little bit of leeway on these details.
Specific answers to that question that are, you know, where you can get answers at the level of the field without
right.
being the case, but also maybe not.
Okay. So I don't have much time, and so I, you know, there's more in the paper if you're interested. But there are, I think, two questions that I want to try to address here in a normative perspective. First of all, the difference between, and that was what, you know, I was urged to do in the last two questions, the difference between a license, an infringement that occurs in the presence of a license, and infringement that occurred between strangers. So assume we have managed successfully cataloged, characterized the violation as an infringement. That will be a second question, how to do that. But suppose we did it, does the fact that the infringer also happened to have a license for something else, should that matter? Should we treat strangers different than contracting parties? And then we see where should we put the line between the infringement and the, so license versus non-license. What we saw is happening here is that through the combination of remedies, infringement remedies increase the recovery relative to contract damages. Not always, but by and large, this is the effect we get. Super compensatory damages. The ex post and ex ante combination definitely do that. That's my argument. Why would we want, so let's think about it as some kind of a punitive damage. Forget about the details how we get there. It's super compensatory. All we know, you know, for remedies people, super compensatory damages are usually punitive, exemplary damages, right? Why do we use punitive damages? Well, we use them, I suggest at least two rationales. There are many others, but in 7,000 words, I don't have room to look at more. Low probability of detection. That's the most common rationale. So the question is infringement by a licensee easier to detect than by a stranger? If the probability of detection, because this person also happens to be a licensee and now they're doing something bad, they have a license for the paperback and they're changing the ending of the book, that is very easy to detect, or anything that they do is more likely to be observable than if strangers do it, then damages here should not be increased. Compensatory damages, lost profit are enough, we don't need any multiplier. Now, it turns out that the effective multiplier, that if the law, what the law does is analogize to a multiplier, the factors are not related, to the probability of detection. First of all, we're talking about, it's a put option, it has nothing to do with the probability of detection. Another element has to do with, we increase damages because we want to increase precaution. By the parties. What kind of precautions will we talk about? Many types of ex-ante precautions by the parties, but we may want the infringer to be, the potential infringer, to take more measures against infringement, knowing that they are subject to super damages, they'll be more cautious. They'll search the landscape of property rights better to make sure they don't step on anybody's toes. Higher remedies would induce greater search, but the question is this search something that is good? We don't just want them to do maximal search, we want to do optimal search, and when search is really costly and not very productive, we don't want to create these incentives. And so damages should be lower, you know, just as a first cut, very, very rough, it should be lower in areas where there is a very crowded patent landscape. I think that is consistent with views of, you know, Mark and others, that currently we have too much recovery in those situations where the, but it is not a reason to make damages lower for licensees. Licensees are more likely than non-licensees to know what are the rights that are implicated, existing rights, and to have low cost of search. They've already searched. So if anybody should be subject to higher damages, it should be licensees, not strangers, according to this rationale. So this rationale doesn't perform any of the work that is necessary for,
I don't want to cut you off. If you're done,
I'm not going to be done. So I want to make sure that I give opportunity to
be. Just a brief then. You can look for me, or you can make yourself easy, or I can make myself easy for you to find me. So I think you're modeling the you look for me cost, but not the other. And I'm sorry Mark left the room, because I disagree with him on the facts. Copying is a funny word, it's usually value laden. I would use a more neutral term. Do the parties know about each other and the possible arguments of infringement? In almost all of these cases, they do before the complaint is filed in court, and in 100% of them, they know at the time the complaint is filed in court, and in the days after MedImmune, the whole reason MedImmune existed is because the class of potential infringers had such notice that they had a reasonable apprehension of suit and wanted to bring suit. And so we know for sure this is not a search cost problem. It's an incentive to actually stay in the room and have a conversation to negotiate a license,
okay,
or incentive to leave the room.
Fair enough. It is a different incentive. I had a part in the paper, I'm not sure I'm going to include it in the final version, of that looks at this incentive as well. It's not, I don't have time to address it here. I don't have time to do much more. Do you want me to spend two more minutes?
You have, we started 3 minutes.
Oh, okay.
And since you're an organizer who's bound by your own rules, you get an extra 30 seconds for complying with the rule of law.
Okay. I feel bad that I didn't leave enough, didn't plan it to have a broader discussion, but you know, the other question has to do, so one question had to do, should we want to treat strangers differently than licensees? By virtue of being a licensee, should you be punished more severely or less severely? I think that we see here that the answer is you should be punished perhaps less severely. According, you know, the detection rationale less severely, the search rationale more severely. But let's go back to the first question that motivated the entire discussion: is it breach or infringement? How can we tell? And so, you know, my hope is to also sketch a model that gives us some better traction for the answer that I'm proposing to think about. But here is the methodology. I think we cannot resolve it by reference to some natural or technological distinctions based on subject matter of contract versus IP or other categories. The fundamental question, as I mentioned at the front, is when do we want damages to be higher? It's only a question of magnitude. Now call it punitive damages, call it infringement damages, whatever you want, use any legal mechanics. But this is the question that we wanted. Should damages be super compensatory, or are we good enough with damages that are make-whole damages? And I argue that if we, so consistent with that, infringement is the label that we affix to the conclusion of a remedy analysis, when remedy should be analysis, and when do we want, on the other hand, to generate greater deterrence of non-voluntary taking of rights. Now, many people here contributed to these questions, and Richard, in a lot of his work on takings, on property rules versus liability rules, talked about it. This is the methodology. It's not, I'm not going to pull any new, trick out of the hat. I think, what activities should the licensor have the right to license separately? Say to the licensee, you cannot just take it. You don't have a call option on these entitlements of mine. I want to license it, you know, or I don't want to license at all. Or are we going to say that any time you give a license, it is a chunky license, because it's not only the right to do the license activity, but it's also coupled with call options to take everything else, pay damages, but take everything else. Do we want licenses to be chunky? The answer has to be, you know, is the same answer that we give in stranger cases. Why isn't everything in the world organized according to Ian Ayer's idea of optional law?
Because
just take things. Exactly. So I am going to say that I would have shown you, and it is the same. We saw it, and we can.
Well, I mean.
Thank you.